Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on today's show we're really lucky to have one of our favorite comic creators working today, Mr. Kieran Gillen, with us. And he has written series for the X-Men and the Avengers and Eternals and Star Wars and Warhammer and a whole bunch of other things. And as a game journalist, he also co-founded the Rock Paper Shotgun site too. So Kieran, thank you immensely for joining us from London today.
Thank you for having me. It's a delightful. I was supposed to say, I'm really excited by your intro video. I was just watching that and going, ooh, that's exciting. So I'm really pumped. I'm glad to be a part of this.
That's great. Now, obviously, we're here today to talk about your Die role-playing game, which is already a smash hit on Kickstarter right at the moment. So congratulations from that. And that is tied into your Die comic that, among other things, won the British Fantasy Award for the best fantasy comic last year. I saw that Matt Mercer, great, amazing. I saw that Matt Mercer said he was entranced by it. And personally, I was just completely, totally blown away by it. So I personally have a burning number of questions that I want to ask you, but just such a fascinating, unique product. Let me start with this. So one thing that stands out to me as being unique with Die is we talk to a lot of people who have taken some beloved literary product, some beloved literary property, and after the fact, they've gone to make a role-playing game to simulate it. And obviously, that's where role-playing games come from with D&D. Mm. But with you, you made this comic and you made this game jointly together, and they're really fused together. The comic talks about making a game, and the game talks about the world of the comic, I've never seen a property like that before. Tell us why you felt you wanted to do it that way.
Yeah, I've got a terrible habit of doing really, really foolish things. You know, that's probably the best way of putting it. And this is just not good. Why on earth would I write 300,000 word RPG system on the same side of the comic, apart from it just felt right? Like, part of it came from a friend of mine, Lee Alexander, the excellent, she's a games writer now, ex-games critic. But we did a thing for one of my previous comics, Wiccan Divine, which is basically, we did an issue which was a magazine issue. And it was done in the style of a beautiful fashion magazine. And of course, I used to write in magazines. And it was all a series of interviews with the characters in the game, the characters in the comic, which I got real world journalists to interview them across instant message. And of course, you know, and it's fun. And they wrote it with real articles. It's a really interesting piece. And she said something like, basically, your work is most interesting when it basically is stuff that only you would do. And I went sort of like, oh, leave me alone. But then I sat back and was like, she's right. Of course, it involves me playing, you know, MUDs in the 90s a lot. That involves me knowing a lot of journalists. That involves me being a games, you know, running magazines. So that all these different sort of skill sets. So as I kind of like leaving Wictive, one of the things I wanted to do was do stuff that no one else would want to do. Or rather, like, you know, I mean, for example, in Eternals, I programmed the name generator for all the deviants with the bad guys. So I broke the phenomes down and turned it into a system that could generate infinite numbers of like individual deviant names. And that's kind of like, I'm not saying no one would do that, but not many people do it from, you know, and dies the VAT off the other scale entirely, you know, as in, oh, no, you're somebody with a broad interest in RPGs and critical stuff. Why don't you go from first principles? Because in some ways, die is, it's tricky because I was about to say as the comic or the RPG, and it kind of has merged into one. For quite a long time, when I was developing them, and it was like, which one's the dog and which one's the tail? Like I was a bit like, which project is kind of like really happening here? And at some point, it basically metabolized. It became that Ouroboros. There's a word I can never reliably say. You know, the snake had its own tail, and it became this one thing. And now I kind of view Die as a kind of okay. This is getting a little bit like culty, but I kind of view Die as an existence outside of the comic and the game. as these are kind of two perspectives you can use to look at the material, and each one's medium reveals different truths. So it's kind of like a hologram. So if you read the comic, you get some stuff in a certain way, and if you read the, play the game, you get stuff in a different one. And you, by playing them both simultaneously, you know, having both of them, you kind of get have an existence outside either. I mean, weirdly, that's how I always felt about, say, Middle Earth as a kid, which I loved as a, you know, it was one of my first fantasy. I was playing video games. I think I played The Hobbit before I read The Hobbit, like the text adventure. So like, I've always approached Middle Earth as a kind of like its existence outside of any individual work. And that's the weirdest, of course, Tolkien. Of course, Tolkien's level of research and his world building, it always feels bigger than the page. And doing something in multiple mediums at once creates an aesthetic effect, which adds to both of them. A solidity which implies it, you know, it's bigger than either can hold. And scene, that's why I did it. I had a phrase this, that's how I justify doing it now. If you asked me at the time, I would just go, it's much more I feel compelled. So it's that kind of like the old, you know, I've got to just, I justify it afterwards. At the time, it was like, okay, this is a stupid idea and you should do it.
That feels, I couldn't sympathize with that anymore. That feels like, frankly, everything about Die just frankly feels creepily close to my brain, to be perfectly honest, Kieran. And, you know, I'm someone who discovered like Lovecraft and Moorcock through D&D, right? I was playing D&D and found their stuff in D&D books first before I ever, you know, pursued the literature to it. So I feel that really close. Now, of course, the Die comic, it just has beautiful artwork by Stephanie Hans. And I think we have a slideshow that we could start. So all kinds of stuff here from the, some stuff from the comic that's going to appear in the bound product for the Die RPG. You know, one thing I know is you're holding. Yeah, go ahead.
So what you're showing at the moment is actually this is unique work from the RPG, because Stephanie's doing a whole load of new stuff for the RPG as well. That's kind of like part of the. Actually, we've hit enough stretch goals that she's going to do a load more. But like she's doing chapter headings and extra art and stuff. And this is like, I think this is for the bestiary. This chapter heading, I must admit, I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's the best tree.
I think you're right. Anyway, I think we got like some chapters coming up first, and then some other stuff. And it's just gorgeous. And I could flip through the artwork that Stephanie did all day. Now, one thing I said, you're currently holding a D20, like right now, yes. I think. and so you kind of write in a couple of places that Die is intentionally somewhat fetishizing our gaming dice. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the role that the gaming dice play and how that reflects on the core mechanics and the classes in your game.
Okay. This is like, sort of pausing to smile. One of the things that Die does is, like, we've kind of won the cultural war, you know? Like, but I think we're all of an age when we grew up with the Satanic Panic. We grew up with, like, having to fight those battles to justify, you know, D&D. You talk about stuff like, you know, Steve Jackson games being raided by the FBI, you know, about, you know, all that stuff. Genuinely, it's a cultural battle. And we've kind of, and part of Die is kind of, we won, let's pretend they were right. You know, let's say, oh no, GMs are cultists and they want to drag us to other worlds and the dice are creepy. You know what I mean? And so we kind of get in, you know what I mean? You're getting a bit of Satanic Panic energy because you think about it, like, I think about my parents, like, look at the D&D dice. How weird are they? Like, if you take away all the cultural stuff and you walk in and you think, what are these objects? And they're kind of, they're magical. And what they are is they're magical objects that allow us access to other worlds. So the core of Die is basically each of the characters are going to get ownership of one of the classic dice, and it's what gives them powers. They're basically the Lord of the Rings. Yeah, these are the rings from Lord of the Rings, but for the Die universe. And, you know, and it's metaphorically speaking about how these dice transform us, or, you know, quote unquote. So that was immediately the idea. And that's why you call it Die. That was one of the bits where, how come that no one's done a horror comic or game called Die? It's literally the low hanging fruit. And of course, now I've realized in respect why, because you can't Google it. still, you know what I mean? It's still the right name.
That might have happened to us this morning, actually.
I'm not always very clever. It's that kind of like, it's a good idea. We should do it. Oh, I didn't think about the problem. So then that point became, okay, when building the world, I want to basically each of these classes to sort of deconstruct some of the classic D&D stuff. That's the kind of, like, I'm going to start with the classic, because a lot of Die is actually looking at, say, stuff that was a bit more trad and then making it weird and like, or trying a conversation of what's really going on, like the deconstructionary aspect. So that's like looking at the dice and what they are and how can you do a twist. So six classes. I can't remember which was the first one I made up. That's Dave the Master, and that's the basically the GM as, and it's the standard antagonist, and it's the D20 class. That's the GM gets the character in the game, who basically plays as the main antagonist. Though the way die goes, it can become, you know, much. It's the person who's dragged. They're the person who's dragged you into the world, and of course they've done it for a reason. Maybe it's more sympathetic or not, and that's kind of the way the game goes. It's basically there's an amazing cartoon in the second edition of Paranoia, which is and they're basically. It's basically of somebody, a load of cops outside somebody's house, and the caption is, come out, Billy. We can tell you're not using the rules modifying for movement. You know, and the joke being is there's no game police to come and stop you doing stuff. And of course, the master is kind of like, yo, no, there is. So what you do, the master basically, they change reality by breaking the rules. They get to play with the rules. You can get to do stuff on the fly and tweak. I mean, some of the stuff is just bending, which is fine. And you got stuff you just entirely break it. It was a great playtest where someone was playing the master as a player, and they changed the decimal point on the overland travel rules, which don't really, you know, as in like, so you know, you normally say like, oh, I'll travel 10 miles a day, and I travel, and it changed, no, I travel 100 miles a day. And, you know, that's the kind of rule tweak they did. And that's, you know, I mean, that's what we call a gamist master, and they're not all like that. And of course, there's these basically reality cops who come up. If you get caught, the reality cops turn up to try to basically stop you. That's an example of one of the classes. So the idea of like, you know, the classic idea, the GM is the GM's cheating. We know the GM's cheating, and they're not mostly. But let's turn that into actually the character class. And that's an example. Then there's, let's just rush through them because I speak for an hour about them. The dictator, which is basically the bard, D4. And the idea is basically leaning into the idea of the idea of a song affecting someone's emotion, that's normal. And then you guys know it's really creepy. So it's basically looking at charm and taking it seriously. The idea that this is, imagine the bard is a horror character. Their art is a thing that can really mess with people. And that's what the dictator does. They can get to, they can do, you know, yes, they can obviously make people obey them, but they can also turn the dial up. There's an amazing bit in the, no, there's a bit I really like in the comic where somebody loved me beyond all reason. And they basically catch fire. You know, their heart is burst into flames because, you know, they've literally been able to do magically powerful effects. That's the dictator. The fool is the D6. Die runs off of like a dice pool system, which is a D6, and you get to add your special dice. The fool is kind of like the other side of the bard, like the swashbuckling, charming kind of person. And it's also the player archetype of the player who isn't taking anything too seriously. There's someone at the table who's less invested, who's making jokes. The fool is basically that. But they get basically super luck powers as long as they treat things lightly. And of course, in a game of series, often as serious as Die, that's hard. You know, like, and it, of course, that all depends on the persona. What they get to do with their D6 is they get to draw on it. So they get to basically scribble things on the side, and basically that if the scribbles turn up, they get basically floops of luck. The D8 is the Emotion Knight, which is kind of our paladin fighter class. Eight-sided dice, therefore classic, you know, longsword damage. There's an old piece of... and basically, instead of being about religion, I made the paladin about emotions. And I use this basically, this 1980s, 1990s style of real psychology. But basically, there's eight emotions of varying intensity. So it goes from sadness to grief. It's that one, that's one of the eight. And the emotion knight, basically, as long as they are getting to feel their emotion, they get to basically power up their powers with their sentient arcane weapon. And that can be from like just being a really good fighter in that way to the creative violence ability that basically allows you to do ridiculously supernatural effects. Like, I don't know, defeat a mountain, defeat someone's sense of loss, you know, and that kind of the idea of almost like that, you know, that bit in Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix, I chop a mountain with the side of my hand. That's kind of what they get to do if they're sad enough or whatever their emotion is. Neo, they're all cyberpunk class because this game is, in the story, is kind of very, very 1991. You know, it was kind of deliberately, there is a kind of period piece vibe to the aesthetics. Neo is kind of the rogue class. That's my analysis of like, worth noting, the D10 is the newest of all the dice, therefore it's the newest, that's the sci-fi dice. They get these cybernetic magical implants, and they get to activate them with fair, what we call fair gold, which is kind of a riff on the fairy gold trope. And it's me basically talking about, like, basically all adventurers are kind of thieves. So why the hell is this weird prejudice against thieves in games? Because everyone's just taking stuff that isn't nailed down. So they basically, the Nii have to have this resource, Fair Gold, which only they're really interested in. But if they cut, it powers their abilities, it allows it to turn it on. It allows it to overcharge it to get really powerful effects. And so they're constantly, they want something no one else really cares about. And it's that moment of like, Nii, no, don't go there. And it's the wonderful moment of like, with a Nii player, you kind of put the, you know, you get a gold coin or whatever, and you put it on the table, and then and you describe it as, oh no, this, tell me about what you most have ever wanted in the world. So tell me about what your persona as in your real world person has ever most wanted in the world. And it's, and you know, people go, oh, you know, the when I first fell in love, when I first saw my wife, when I first got my Nintendo 64 or whatever, then it's like, yeah, this is, a, this makes you feel that much. And then seeing what the player does, because there's literally two schools. That one is, ooh, that's a bit dangerous. I better stay away from that. I better be careful. And there's the other sort who is scrambling over the table to try to grab the gold coin. The Nii. And finally, the Godbinder. The Godbinder is basically the analysis of the cleric. Like, because you think about it, it's so weird, the kind of relationship with gods in a classic D&D, as in, you know, yes, I will heal you, but only for, like, D8 wounds. Like, what kind of god does a crappy miracle like that? And it kind of just... you know, and Godbinder is basically the idea of this person who's basically bartering of gods for miracles. And it can be like, on low levels, it's something we call scripture, which is something more like spells. And on the high level, it's literally whatever you want. Or whatever that god could do. But they've got to pay the price. And the price is obviously compared to what you've just made them do. And that's a really great way to drive plots. And that's basically the six of the class. I mean, they're a bit... as you see, they kind of hit the major archetypes, but they're also deliberately made to be quite flexible. So, like, if you want to make the Godbinder more like a magician, you can make it work as well. And at the Nii, you know, he's basically a rogue, but you choose the right gifts, you can get basically a classic cyberpunk Terminator-esque bruiser as well. You know, so they're all designed to be a bit flexible, but that's kind of the core of them. And rest.
Cool, super cool. It's super, you know, I was initially really surprised that you have the Nii cyberpunk character in the book. And it's funny because we were just running a cyberpunk game on our channel Thursday nights a couple weeks back, actually. So we're very into that. And of course, like in the book, the character that plays the Nii is actually a video game coder. And I guess I should point out, for example, Paul and I first met when we were video game engineers in the late 90s, as a matter of fact, is how we know each other. And you even go so far as to have crunch time in the video game industry actually be a really important plot element for one of the characters in their relationships action. I was like, wow, he is really digging really deep into what it's like to be in the game industry. That was like, I did not expect that when it showed up on the page. Now, one thing that you very briefly touched on for a second ago is Dai is really deep on the role play aspect, and I think there's at least some of the Nordic LARP tradition kind of bursting through at the seams in places. And so, having watched one or two of your actual play sessions, what happens is the players come and sit at the table, and you have them make characters for the fictional Earth, and then you have them get up and walk away for a beat, and then you come back and you sit down at the table, and now you're playing those Earth characters, and then those characters make other characters for the Dai fantasy world. So in the rules, you have to distinguish between these three different people, the player and the real world character and the fantasy world character. Why was that important? Why didn't you just like make PCs and you're in the fantasy world like every other game does?
I think like it's one of the things like you very well you described Dai and it sounds incredibly meta, which of course it is. But like there is that kind of it's a game about RPGs. And especially like it's what we do in the comic in that way. You know what I mean? Like we sit down and we sit down as real people and then we generate pretend people and then we become those pretend people. So I can't, you know what I mean? Echoing the structure, and to be honest, the word I often use is like re-enchanting. The idea of like, no, let's make this magical. One of my favorite really small parts is when you hand out the dice to the players, and the players create the characters, And then you kind of do the whole final ritual, which is basically the thing that transports you to the die. And it's everyone takes their dice and close their eyes and lower them to the table. And that's weird. And it works really well. It's a really small bit of sizzle. And then you kind of, you open your eyes, you're somewhere else. And that's the core of the RPG promise. I can imagine Grant going to burst through the door if I say the word Cartesian, which is normally what happens. But there is a bit of like, the important thing is the persona. Like the persona is what we call the people in the real world. Like that whole section is a really free-form conversation. There's a list of questions people answer, and you build up your social group, because that's the key thing of Die. It's like the characters are lighter in role, like quite light in roles. So that whole bit when you make the person you transform into, that's more like a power-up, really. The people who matter are the persona, because the persona is where you're going to get the world you come from. Like the gym is going to, like if you've got a bad relationship with your dad, or your dad's dead and you never made up to him, your dad's a dragon, you know, your dad's going to turn him as a dragon you're going to finally face. You know what I mean? It's basically mining people, the persona's backstories, and turning it into psychodrama in the fantasy world. So making sure the persona was the real thing. And of course, especially people, okay, I'm going to dial back a couple of steps there. The other important thing is people think, oh, that sounds quite tricky. And the thing is, it really isn't. Like the great, what I most like about Die is you spend so long, you spend an amount of time developing these real world people. And you get to know them. Like even if you don't know, you know, anything at all about games, you can answer questions about real world people because you are one. You know, I don't have to be an orc, but I've been a human being for like most of my life. So that, you know, that makes it really kind of accessible there. And so when you actually go to a fantasy world, there's a lot of the game which is about reminding the players that they're not the characters they transform into. That's just like powers. You are somebody from the real world in a weird situation. And that is the thing that grounds it. And that's the thing that makes people be able to roleplay. And that's where you get the kind of the very small Nordic lot section, which is only like 20 minutes. Whereas you're playing your persona, because it's really about embodiment. Like giving people a chance to start experimenting with speaking like that person. But in a situation where you're really doing something else, you know, what you're really doing is filling in some boxes on the sheet. So it's a safe place to start playing with your character. You're not immediately thrown into like the challenging RPG stuff of it. It's a safe sort of like a play area. And then you go into, when you actually go into Die itself, it becomes something much more like a classic Arneson Gygaxian model where you have a GM and players and you use that kind of structure. But for me, it was like, something like a whistle stop tour. I mean, I love RPGs, you know. So whistle stop tour stuff I've loved. Like, here we go. Like, the opening persona stuff is really a narrative. You know, it's absolutely a narrative game. It's about questions and answering questions and building and et cetera. Then you've got this micro-Nordic lore, which is also developing character sheets, you know. And then you're into a classic RPG kind of setup, which people would be quite familiar with some modern twists in terms of, like, how various things operate. Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like a... I wanted that. It's a love letter. I mean, Die is a really cynical love letter, but it's a love letter nevertheless.
I'm super curious about that the development there of the persona, and whether or not, I guess I've seen that trope a lot, and we've seen it in fiction, characters from the real world being thrust into fantasy world, whether it's, you know, Jumanji or the Guardians of Flame series or the Game Earth trilogy or any of that stuff, felt like it was very popular. And I feel like I've seen a few folks try to reproduce that in an existing, trad RPG. And a lot of times the way it comes across is, well, we'll just play ourselves. And did you ever explore that? Yeah. I'm curious if that's, did you immediately reject that concept or did you play with it ever?
Like, so the thing to remember, of course, the original Blackmoor games, that was a scenario. That was that they were actually dragged into the, you know, this is like, weirdly, this is a fundamental RPG plot. And yet it's something we've seen quite a few times. And that's what makes it interesting for me. As in, it's almost a forgotten part of our roots. I mean, I remember, like, what's the name for that sort of game? When I listened in the 90s, it was Avatar Games. It was described as me, as you play yourself. And I've, back in the day, I used to regularly run my Christmas game with my friends, and it was always you play yourself. And it was always an apocalyptic, dumb, hilarious. And it was, and that's the only way you get away with it, because it's a comedy game. It's a zombie apocalypse, and, you know, Kieran's just, the opening scene is like my character gets, you know, eaten alive by a zombie, and everyone has to start dealing with it. You know what I mean? Like, because if you're playing yourself, immediately you get bleed, as in the character, it gets far too personal immediately. For me, it's like, if you're going to do a serious game, unless you're really in a very intense, like, social group where it's very safe, you need the distance of fiction. Like, and that's one of the most important bits of, like, the get divide. when asking a player, you say, hey, what does your persona, you know, what does your persona, Jezebel, think about this? You don't say, what do you think about this? Because that's the other thing about Die. The fact you're using real world people, even with a fictional layer, people often mine stuff. So, you know, yeah, you've got the fig leaf, this isn't me, but it's still at some point, you're probably going to get something that's quite familiar. And then you're going to be able to play with it in a safe way, but it's still kind of dangerous and exciting. So that was, for me, the reason why you had to do it that way. And of course, it's also the, there's so much about the game where you get it from mining their, especially also the stuff you choose. If you choose to account, oh, my character's obsessed by, I don't know, Tolkien or Taylor Swift or David Bowie or whoever, that's something probably you like too. So therefore, it's a thrill for you when you go into the fantasy world and suddenly David Bowie is the king of hell and Taylor Swift is leading an army of Valkyries trying to fight it or whatever. You know, that stuff that matters to your persona, but it also stuff that matters to you as a real person. I mean, like, I remember, like, the first time I threw David Bowie as an NPC at somebody, the entire table basically exploded in joy. So there's a bit of that. But I think that's why you need persona, because it gives you kind of distance, but also gives you closeness. Mm-hmm. And also, so much about Die is the set scenario, the set structure for the game is kind of what's in the comic. As you go to the fantasy world, then have to come to an agreement whether to come home or not. So having persona, since that's got a fairly like rigid structure in some ways, the persona being so variable is what gives the game its variability. Like, it can be whatever. It just depends on how messy the people are on the way in. And, like, you know, imagine a game played of, like, all the characters are 16-year-old and they're, you know, and they're 16-year-old from, like, a really posh school or whatever. And we compare that to a game where, oh, yeah, this is a group of 70-year-olds and old people home. You know, and like it doesn't, you know, or anything. It can be all soldiers playing it in the front line, you know, in a war, and they're just, this is their downtime. Because a lot of people play RPGs in the downtime and all that kind of stuff. And by taking real people and throwing them into a ritualized situation, you get real interesting novelty from the players. And for me, that's the joy that also, even having the very clean rules at the end, in that kind of, do we stay or go? It's got to be a vote. Everyone's got to agree. And if they don't, you know, and dead people don't get votes. And that's where the spice comes from, the reality game horror of it. And then becomes the question of, what is your persona willing to kill for? Or are they, you know, is that kind of, yeah, I want to stay here, but there's no way I'm killing my friends. And then, although there's infinite numbers of varieties there, means you just don't know how it's going to play. And I've had games where it's like, it is Jumanji. It's the kind of the fun adventure. Like, yeah, the master who dragged us in is a complete bastard. We're going to go across this adventure, murder them, like, don't take us, and we're going to go home. There's other games where everyone, you realise the master's dragging you in is really a cry for help. You know, it's them trying to wrestle parts of their identity they can't face in the real world. And everyone has a big hug, everyone cries, and they go home, and in the real world, they try to be better, you know? And sometimes it's both therapy and sword fights, which is great, you know what I mean? And it all depends upon the meta question of Die, is kind of like, why do we play RPGs? And when you sit down and play the game, yeah, you're asking the persona, what they care about in fantasy, but you're really asking the players as well. And as a group, together, you decide what it's going to be like. And I love that, you know what I mean? That's like, it's an RPG, certainly it's an RPG about RPGs, but it's also, and it takes that seriously, but it also takes that with heart. That's, to me, that's the important thing, because, like, it's very easy for me to disappear down the meta hole, but really, it's just really emotional. Like, that's the thing, like, you get the kind of, like, oh yeah, this is really affecting, or occasionally really hilarious, because that's the thing, you know. Yeah, anyway, I'm a fan.
Awesome.
thank you for actually kind of outlining what the end game of Die is, actually, the fact, because I didn't know if I was allowed to spoil it, actually. But of course, the whole thing builds toward this really interesting end game where the party has to come to a unanimous decision about whether to go back to the real world or not, actually. And in case of a dispute, anybody who's dead, they don't get a vote. So there's an out. There's a mechanic for resolving the dispute if someone really doesn't want to get on board with the rest of the group, and it's possibly very violent.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like, it doesn't. It's one of the things. It definitely doesn't have to be. I mean, we've got quite a lot of safety. There's a lot of safety tools, especially because it's a with comic readers. People may not be familiar with, like, safety tools or how hard a game can go. But definitely, at default, it's like, oh yeah, there's no player violence except possibly in the climax. That's kind of the default of the game. As in, yeah, when things get really heated, maybe it is, but that's at the end of the game, therefore it's different. And of course, the other thing about the end, the climax is, in the standard game of Die, there's also a time limit. Like, the world's going to end unless you make a decision. So it's not like you're going to sort of be able to sit down and go, okay, we'll work this out. It's like, oh no, sky's falling to pieces. I need to go home to feed my kid a pizza or whatever. I'm going to have to find my old gym teacher and see what happens. So yeah, that's kind of, you know, you say it's interesting. And you also say about the spoilers of it in terms of, like, how much do you want to give away? And I kind of figure anyone listening to this is like, they probably want to know what they want to get into. Like, and especially with the safety tools in the game at the start of the game, we say, sorry, I forgot what I said. At the start of the game, we make clear that there is a possibility for, like, at the climax, there is going to be the possibility of this. Unless people decide they don't want that, then it has a, you take that off the table. And then very early, when you arrive in Die, you get the rules explained to you. Because I think knowing what the rules are is why it's interesting. It's like watching any, it's like a reality TV show. People have got to know the rules before they start playing the game. And it's in a very real way, the climax of Die, when you've got those very clean rules, it's like something out of Drag Race. You know, it's like, this is like a game everyone is playing now. And they're going to see how they're going to do it. Especially when you've got the meta. Oh, I don't know. Do you want to talk about the Fallen? Let's talk about the Fallen.
Great. They're important.
Yeah. I mean, that's also the other thing. When someone gets killed in Die, they get up as a zombie monster called the Fallen. So it was, just because you've been killed doesn't mean that you're not there anymore. And the thing about Fallen is, if they kill another member of the party, they come alive again. So, you know, there's that aspect to it as well. Which is, and it's so funny. I mean, we're talking about the two being developed together. Like, I named the Fallen in the comic first, but the idea that the Fallen were just real people came in from the game. And that was me trying to solve the problem of player elimination. Because it's, you know,
great.
Die counts are quite fragile. So, like, giving them, like, get up, there's a problem. As in, you know, the problem is now you're not going home. Unless. And, of course, that's also part of the, you know, the very basic setup of the system is, since you've got the antagonist who took you there, you've got at least one person who might be okay to eat to get become alive again. You know what I mean? So that despite you've got the tension, you've also got the possibility of a happy ending. And, of course, there's also possibility of ways to become back to life outside of the basic setup. But that's the core game.
Super cool. You know, one thing that I love in the comic, and I don't think we've said it, I mean, the Die comic is very tight. You had 20 issues, and that was the end of it. And they're all available in compilations, complete compilations at this point. And Kieran also has fairly extensive essays at the end of every issue. So usually there's a 3, 4, 5, 6 page essay about the research that you did and the thinking of the design of both the game and the comic that I found to be completely invaluable. And I totally just completely fell into that every time. One thing you pointed out is that on the issue of spoilers, which is why I say this, is you had the game available, or at least designed right off the bat, and you write at one point, like around issue 5, you go, I really wanted to release it, but I felt that I couldn't because there's spoilers in the game for what's going to happen in the comic. And I think it's specifically the point where you reveal the issue with the Fallen in the comic, where you go, I think now I can actually release the beta rules of the game because now you know.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really fascinating how like the problems that you were solving doing both of these at the same time. Let me point out one thing. Okay, so one thing you're talking about is the issues with the fictional Earth persona feeding into the why do we play? Why are people playing RPGs? And so reading the very first issue, I don't think this is a huge spoiler, of the comic, the real world people go to the fantasy world, and sometimes I'm slow, honestly, and a couple pages later, I was like, wait a minute, the gender ratio is not the same as what it used to be. Where did that switch? And I had to go back and figure out that Dominic, who's a man in the real world, is Ash, who is a woman in the fictional world and has a very full life as a woman there. And without saying too much, that's an important plot point. I think that many of us have friends who used RPGs to explore or come out as queer at some point in a gentle fashion. And we are very thankful to have a safe zone for them to do that. Why did you personally feel that that was important to have as a plot element in Die?
I don't know. First, I think for all the reasons you've just described is the reasons why it was important to do. I mean, like, Die is about RPGs, and it takes RPGs very seriously. And in other words, I'm sure this is how people use... And if the question is, why do we play games? That certainly includes stuff like that. As in, like, you talk about all the dungeons we've gone down, but the real treasure mainly taken is a knowledge about yourself. It's where, I mean, this isn't spoilers, really, but, like, there's a bit where Ash, towards the end, talks about games being a conversation, you know, which is the classic PBTA kind of way of viewing games. But of course, if it's a conversation, you should be aware of what it's telling you. And, like, you're right, there's so many people who have discovered and used games as a safe place to explore parts of themselves. And parts of themselves they may not have even been aware of until they've started to play with themselves there. And that's magical, and that's powerful. The thing about, like, RPGs is imagining of someone else. It's also, like, what other person do you imagine you are? And then you realise, no, this is part of me. And you know, absolutely. And especially, like, I don't want to say too much about where the story goes. But also, just dungeon. I mean, talking about myself, you know, I'm a queer person. You know, this is all very much me talking about stuff, which very much how I view games. So, like all this stuff for all the characters has that. In fact, that kind of, if you look at the group, there's a bit of that in there as well. As in, all the characters are not just. I'm trying to make them a real social group, but also they're like different sorts of players, people who came to games for different reasons. I imagine Chuck is the fool, who's the person not taking it too seriously. You know, but then, you know, and Ash is somebody who takes it intensely seriously in a different, because Ash has got emotional stakes here. And you know, we go through the different group in different kind of ways like that. So, it just felt to be dishonest. And also I wanted to write about it. There is that kind of simple as in, I don't want to, you know, this is stuff I want to write about because it's stuff I've never written about. So as a creator, there's always that to it.
I don't feel like I had seen it dealt with that way in certainly in a comic or role playing before. So that hit me really hard when you have that arc in the book. So I was among the things that really hooked me.
Thank you. Honestly, it's like, and it's, I hope it reads genuine and sincere and complicated. Like, that's the thing, is I didn't want to make it a really easy story either. Like, I think Ash is more complicated than a simple narrative, and there's certainly different readings you can take on her as well. And just at least part of the reasons why I leave it quite open at the end is to allow interpretation, as in if someone wants to take it that much, take it one way or the other, they can make it more, it's more like themselves. But at the same time, it's definitely something, you know, Ash 100%, it's weird. It's a coming out story, which kind of like doesn't quite tell you the reader what Ash has decided, but at the same time, it's absolutely a coming out story.
That's great. You just answered one of my questions that I would have asked. Actually, is exactly what is that end state? Without any spoilers, you totally answered it. So thank you.
Yeah, the last thing Ash says, just like Sophie, is like, I've got so much to tell you. So it's definitely that kind of like, and Ash isn't talking about Die. You know, Ash is talking about something much else. If we ever did a sequel to Die, obviously I would have to come down and say something. You know what I mean? At the moment, and I've certainly got my own take, but at the moment I'm okay with just going with the text. Like, because people have kind of there's a discussion about genderqueerness in there, which is like certainly a read, but it's not, Ash doesn't say that, it's just put on the table as something we're talking about. But actually, I think it's weird, you can quote key lines without Defank spoiling it, and whatever I decide, I decide. And that's kind of, I think, really important, like how people use games and queerness broadly. As in, like, no, it's your decision. You know, you get to think about it, and you get to, like, what is it for you, and that's valid. I hope. Anyway, that's my hope. Anyway.
Cool, super. That was among the many things. That's the thing that drove me to read the entire series in one night. Frankly, different subject. I have that you've mentioned a couple times in some of your writing. For quite a while, I've had a thesis that original Dungeons & Dragons is fundamentally a horror game. And and as an example, that love him or hate him, H.P. Lovecraft is really at the root of the pulp tradition that fed into Gygax's D&D, exactly, at least. And he was a huge influence on Howard and Lieber and Merritt and all those kinds of guys that were the founding documents for the D&D pulp tradition. So you, again, hopefully not too much of a spoiler, you literally put Lovecraft at the root of your world. Did you always know that the die story was fundamentally cosmic horror, or did that dawn on you at a later date? Was that the plan all along, or did that creep up on you?
Oh, no, definitely the cosmic horror of Die was very real. Like, you know, like, I kind of always... I talk about Rocco's Basilisk, which is, like, one of the influences. But the idea of...
Tell us about Rocco's Basilisk if we didn't know what that was.
Oh, it's dangerous to tell people about Rocco's Basilisk.
Or just let him... Yeah. Maybe but just Google that.
But in reality, the idea of, like, something in the future... Oh, this is real, heading towards spoilers. The cosmic horror of it felt very real. You know, like the idea of like, because I'm an existentialist, so I believe in free will. You know, I believe in choice. And of course, that's very much a gamer perspective. And the idea of there's something really, what's the horror of the gamer? And I guess part of the horror of the gamer, the idea of none of my choices matter. And you know, if you do a horror story about gaming, making it cosmic horror, like is a way to make it feel horrible. Because that's definitely why it feels goth. That's the awful majesty of the thing, I guess. So yeah, it was always there, and I always sort of knew we'd get to Lovecraft eventually. You know, and we hit other kind of, we call 20 for people that don't, Die itself, which is not necessarily where your games are set, but the comic is set in a D20 world. Each one of the sides is basically got a master, and the master is the person who shapes its aesthetics. And I don't really, and it's kind of, it's not just like, say that the Narnia realm is all kind of like just Narnia. It's what it, or like the Tolkien realm is like Middle Earth. It's not, it's basically a conversation and deconstruction of it. So like the realm of the Tolkien master is very much about World War One. It's about how, you know, it's about where Tolkien got so much of the emotional like material that went into Lord of the Rings. So all the realms are kind of like conversations about like what it's really about, or one way of looking at it anyway, which is kind of thing. And the Lovecraft realm is just mainly okay, it's a horror realm. It's horrific. But it is also it's something quite tongue-in-cheek because, I don't want to completely spoil it, but the idea of, like, if you think about it, RPG groups are kind of like Lovecraftian cults. You know, all these kind of weird kids in the 80s, like mainly very white, pallid kids hiding in dark rooms, saying words no one understands, like, FACO, FACO. You know, that's a bit like a Lovecraft cult. And that was kind of like the idea of like, and this returns to like the satanic panic ideas. The idea of like, let's pretend we're all, you know, or at least in that one realm, let's say RPG kids are like Lovecraft cults. That seems funny and bleak as well. You know what I mean? Also, you know, there's a real bleak comedy element there, but at the same time, still being a horror story. But then you get something like H.G. Wells is in there because, of course. That was all. The other thing about Die as a comic, it's also the idea comes from me, of course, being an ex-critic. But Die is, of course, also a living critical argument about what made up RPGs. So we've got each of the realms, they've got these masters, and these masters are things that went into RPGs. So you've got a realm which is, I said Tolkien, Tolkien's master, Lovecraft as master. We've got a realm which is the Brontes, you know, Charlotte Bronte, which, of course, this is very much reading what John Peterson's kind of analysis, you know, John Peterson's sort of freefall model of genre, mechanics, and essentially means, as in, so the paracosm the Bronte kids did whilst talking around the table, kind of an RPG if you squint, and it's certainly that conversational model. Then, of course, you don't actually meet them in the comic, but you've got the Prussian... the two Prussian aristocrats who did the original Kriegspiel. They're like behind Eternal Prussia, which is like one of the regions. We've also got H.G. Wells, and H.G. Wells is, anyone can disagree with this, but like one of the very earliest bits of commercial wargaming, as in wargaming for people to buy in shops, was done by H.G. Wells. And I love the idea of H.G. Wells' really important work, wasn't all the big books we know, was a set of like wargame rules he did in 1911. As an attempt to stop World War II. And of course, that becomes the plot too. That was very much like the idea of like when you start thinking about RPGs as a conspiracy and the idea that like you have a cosmic horror take on RPGs, anything that happened suddenly becomes creepy. And there's a, and the second you start looking at the dates of all those things I've just described, it becomes really creepy, which is a delight, you know, because that gives a completely different strain. It's so much like, this is the stuff I think so much more in the comic than the game, because the game is much more about the persona, the emotional meat of it. And like, there's not really what we deliberately haven't done in the RPG, and it's sort of thing we might do in an expansion down the line. It's like, we don't tell you how to do our H.G. Wells, or, you know, those realms aren't in the game. It's lots, you know, we have stuff like the core big ingredients, so like Die, Fallen, the Fair, who I haven't talked about, the classes, the stuff that makes it feel like Die. But then we've got ways to really turn people's obsessions into the world. Or like really quick ways to look. You know, I mentioned like the Taylor Swift and Bowie of it all. Like ways to take the persona's obsessions and turn them into this stuff for this game. So that stuff's more important for the game. But the comic very much is like, okay, I'm going to give you an essay in the form of, because that's the other thing about it being a world of all these masters in. It's not static. So like, you know, the Prussian war, the Prussian realm being eternally at war with Little England is really, or an Angria, is really a war over between, is story or narrative more important? You know, and you can imagine, it's literally turning that into like the world politics. yeah, it's fun. We have fun. And you know, Stephanie drew incredibly beautiful things. It still does.
Yeah. Definitely. I was talking to my partner Isabel here last night about the literary characters that show up, and there's a great and scary moment with Wells, and I was trying to get her to guess the four that appear in the comic, and of course the one that she would not have guessed was Charlotte Bronte, and she pretty much just fell off the sofa she was sitting on when I told her that was one of the four main gaming influences. One of your essays, you say that you discovered that yourself in John Peterson's Playing at the World. And John's a big friend of the show, actually. We've had him on once before. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll have him on again. So it's interesting like how much of the structure in Playing at the World that Peterson identifies you actually kind of use in multiple places of Die. But let me ask about this, again, this persona thing. So there's a near the... Having read the beta rules of the RPG, there's a place at the end, I'm gonna quote you here for a second, where you write, under narrative RPGs, you write, "I'd argue that the major mode of narrative RPGs at the moment involves players influencing the game world's creation directly. As in, rather than the GM creating the world that the player just moves through, the players and the GM collaborate in some way to create the details of the reality, not just the actions of a player's characters in the environment. Die does not tend to work like this, at least not always." So maybe you can tell us, what is the different approach that Die takes to that kind of thing?
I tell you, the one really good thing, there's so much beta stuff out there at the moment. I said, like, and I don't know how, I think it's about 200,000 of like beta materials out there, and there's like another 100,000 extra stuff I wrote, and that's been cut down enormously. And that the real joy of working with Rowan Rook and Deckard is the distillation. And in some ways, how much I've learned in terms of expressing what I always played as a, in much tighter ways. We've got like, I thought I was just tweaking the principle section in terms of these are the core Die GM rules. And so like, these are like all the kind of stuff I'm flirting around with there. I do. What I'm really talking about there is the Cartesian aspect. Again, second word of Cartesian is the idea that the there's these two other principles. One of them is in the real world, the players have final complete autonomy. So in other words, you get to define anything you want about your character in the real world. So in other words, oh yeah, my dad didn't love me. I'm really into Transformers. I own a sports car, but I wish I had a better sports car. Anything you want, you can define, you have final say. Whilst in the fantasy world, the GM has the final say. And what the GM doing is mining your real world stuff. And of course, and for me, that's like, you know, we don't have control of the real world. You know, I can't change what's outside the window. And there's something in the classical RPG which is really interesting. The GM takes the concept of reality, which of course is what the D20 symbolizes in Die. So that kind of the idea of like you're prodding this external reality to you and you don't quite know how it's going to work is part of the game's magic. However, where Die does work is, and this is, I think, where it becomes easy to run and actually feels much more like a modern narrative game, is the GM has complete control, which also means the GM can throw that control back. So a classic Die situation would be like, okay, you're heading to this forest. Then, okay, Dan, tell me about your persona's grandma's house. And you describe the grandma's, and I'm great. And I say, okay, that's in the, that house is exactly there in the woods ahead of you. Except one difference. There's an enormous wolf with your grandma's face curled upon the roof. So that's an example of like, oh no, you're still doing world creation stuff, but it's very much ritualized. And you're, and the fun bit about Die is you have a lot of power, you know that's going to be important. You don't quite know how it's going to be used. And that is that's the fun, weird spice, as in, you know, it's like putting your hand in a trap. You know it's going to bite you. So there's an excitement. And you're like, okay, I'll tell you about my grandma's house. What's going to happen now? And that's what I mean. And that's what I think is the interesting ritual of Dyas. And it's using quite modern narrative techniques, but a slightly different twist in how it operates. And of course, like the GM has quote unquote the final say, can throw the choice back on people. And they really can. Like a classic thing in a Die campaign is like, if anyone's a writer, there's a realm which is about your unfinished novel, you know. And like, you ask questions, oh, in your fantasy novel, tell me about the capital. And then you go, here's the cap, you know. So it's also, you know, you can absolutely use all those techniques, but you're also aware that the GM is going to be warping them in different ways because they have that final say. So yeah, that's kind of what I was sort of reaching at there.
That's great. I'm going to throw up a comment that Gregory Morrison had on YouTube a couple minutes back. He said, "What I found interesting." I think he's played the Die RPG. What I found interesting about asking the questions there in the persona generation is that they almost create a promise that the answer will become relevant in the game in the future. And I think Gregory goes on to say, particularly if you've played the game before and you kind of know that they're going to get twisted into some kind of weird, creepy opposition later on. So it sounds like Gregory finds that very effective.
I'm glad Gregory does. That for me is absolutely it. Because it's one of these things like, if somebody chooses to play this classic GMing stuff even, but if someone chooses to play like the badass warrior, that means I want to fight somebody. So GM, give me someone to fight. And if you choose as a persona saying, I've had a bad relationship with I miss my dog, you want to see the dog. You know, like, there's a big essay in the beta which I've actually cut because it's not necessary. Actually, I'm not sure. I think Rowan did cut it. I don't think it's in the final book, but it's the concept of like throwing balls. This is kind of like a narrative thing which writers do. So much of narrative structure is just recognizing that a ball has been thrown. So, in other words, if at the start you say, I want to get to Mount Doom, that's a ball in the air. At some point, you are going to get to Mount Doom or give up. And if you never mention Mount Doom again, that feels weird. So there's a lot about Die structure is about recognizing what is a ball. And this is kind of like part of where the final game is much better than the beta is, we do a lot of rituals. So instead of giving this broad GM advice of how to identify what's important to a persona, we break it down. So that instead of having completely free-form questions, which of course you can still do, we get very set questions. You know, we get some set questions which we know will give juicy answers. And then after you've scribbled everything down, we give a kind of, here's a checklist of like, here you identify what's really important to this person. So that's the character's backbone. You know, that's their fatal flaw, essentially, as in what's really wrong with their life. And then you just write a list of all the other kind of minor elements. Because there's also things like, for example, as they say, it's the difference between what you need to include. Like saying, like, I hate my life because my career is over and my wife left me. And, you know, I don't think I have any hope. And I wish I was in a better world when I was a hero. You know, that's something like that. You know it has to turn up, otherwise the story would be broken. But if you mention, oh yeah, I really like playing a Monopoly, or like, you know, something like that, you'll be surprised when your ex-wife turns up in like the boot from Monopoly to crush you or something. You know, like there's a mixture between what is necessary and what is fun spice, because the fun spice is a surprise. You know, and if you don't use that stuff, no one cares. Oh, and that's the other thing, like that persona gen stuff. Like this is also one of those cool rules I meant the principles. Like persona gen never ends. You know, just because you've done all the questions at the beginning and asked a bunch, you can always ask more. You know, I mentioned the what's your grandma's house question earlier. You know, and that's because, that, you know, all the way through, the GM will almost always be asking questions about Persona's real world to mine more stuff, which is relevant. And it's also useful because the longer the game goes on, the more you want to remind them they are people from the real world rather than just fantasy characters. There's definitely kind of, that's another one of the principles. If it gets too fantastical, ground it. And if it ever gets too grounded, make it weird. Like, for example, a classic die technique is, like, if it starts feeling like a classic RPG, probably want to question. Like, if you just, like, let's say you killed an orc or something, and it's like, in a game, you don't, and what the sort of classic GM thing would do is stop and go, hey, have you ever hit anyone in the real world? You know, and bring it back. And then, like, how does it, you know, your sword went through it. How do you feel to having done this? And just stop and really ask them how they feel as a persona. Because it immediately takes you back from the tropes. And of course, vice versa. If it comes really grounded, you probably want to throw in a dragon. Or like a dragon with the face of your dead dog or whatever. So there's a lot of dead dogs in here. Like, I don't know why it's upsetting. Near the normal and ground the fantastic. That's another cool dice with principle. And I think, as I said, this is for me is the excitement, because we've got it so much better to make it easier to do it now. Like, the rituals are really quite tight. I mean, there's really my favorite one. It's so basic. As in, how do you make an interesting monster? And it's like idea plus idea equals novelty. So like a bandit chief is boring. But a bandit chief who is like your old school bully is interesting. Just take any two ideas from that list, you know, that list of stuff you've gathered for Persona Gen and a list of standard gaming tropes, put the two together and you've suddenly got, oh no, that's interesting now. Or at least interesting enough for an RPG. So yeah, it's fun. Like, I'm really proud of what the whole, all of RRD have done with this. Like, I really think it's neat.
Super powerful.
So we are running out of time. Unsurprisingly, probably barely scratched the surface here, Kieran. But I just wanted to ask if there was anything about the game or the comic or them together that we haven't touched on that you feel like is really important that we make sure the audience knows about.
I don't know, like, probably, I mean, honestly, I'm giving you a real kind of big random dive on it. And it's kind of like the comics collected in a hardcover in November as well, so that's available from comic shops soon. The game, RRD have done so much work on this, and we're really kind of drilling down into how can we make this successful. Because it's like, as I said earlier on, I'm aware of when you start describing it, how meta it sounds like it's difficult. And I swear it's not. Like, I think we've got it in a way which is completely playable by people who are new to gaming. Because there is a level of accessibility to playing a real person in a weird situation. So all that kind of stuff, like, I'm really like happy with where it's ended up. And the Kickstarter, go nose, see if you like it. There's a video of like me and Grant talking. Both of us got COVID by doing that video. So please watch the video.
Oh, no. very briefly, there's a moment in the comic where people are surprised to be back in 2020 and don't know what the masking's all about. That hit me pretty hard. Yeah. Paul and I were at a gaming convention in 2019. We were watching what's coming up with D&D, and we dawned on both of us, like, next year's 2020. That's very important for gaming. We'll clearly all be rolling with advantage next year. And it turned out to be exactly the opposite. 2020 was completely cursed. You totally observed that in the Die comic. So it just hit everything that's been happening to us, like, super well. Go ahead.
No, I was like, for me, it was Cyberpunk 2020. You know, like, so I was always like, think that was like the aspect of it. And it was like, I didn't cause the pandemic, but that kind of like, oh no, they're gonna get back in May 2020 or whatever. So I've got to. This is the react, and of course, it gives it a really weird scourging of the Shire time of mode. You know what I mean? Like, and obviously, I didn't plan that or even want to do it. It was just kind of let's write reality, because a lot of my work. In my indie work, it's always set in a time period. Like, even if it's right now, I want it set in a, you know, it's almost like historical fiction in the present. Like, so that was at least part of it.
Yeah. I was personally just super affected by the comic, and it's one of my favorite comics I've ever read now. And I would recommend anybody that's interested in role-playing games to go get the Die comic, and also check out the Die Kickstarter, which is already an enormous smashing success. It's a great work that you've done, Kieran. Everybody should check it out.
Thank you. Also, you're incredibly kind. And the fact that, you know, it was one of those bits when you did buy the comic, it's like, oh, is there enough like people who take RPG seriously to buy this? And it's done really well, you know. It's that kind of like it's a leap of faith in terms of, oh, there's an audience for this. And there is an audience for this, which is great. So I'm glad it worked for you.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Viewers, if you would like to find links to the Kickstarter or where to find the comic or just more information about Die in general, you can check out the description of the video here on YouTube. That should be placed there for posterity. So please check it out. And if you have any questions or comments about meta RPGs or how how the classic trope of getting sucked into a fantasy world plays out in gaming, leave us a comment, leave us a question. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that will spin us into further detailed conversations down the road.
Yeah, definitely. We'll look forward to that. And remember, of course, that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs, if you're new to the channel. We are on YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook and GitHub, if you're a coder, and also TikTok. And we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites, so look for us there, please.
If you prefer to listen to this show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those files are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find us on various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Google Podcast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us there. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, we really do. And as usual, enormous thanks to our patrons who support the Wandering DMs show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You'll see a couple different tiers, benefits like behind-the-scenes videos and polls, discounts on merch, access to a private Discord server where we continue the chat live by video every Sunday, and we'll be there in about 10 minutes. So please join us there, and you'll be there today, Paul, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely consider come joining us if you're really interested. You want to talk more about Die? Toss a dollar at us on Patreon. Get into the Discord, and we'll roll you into the conversation.
Yeah, we'll look forward to that. Of course, I'll be back late Thursday night here Eastern Time in New York for more of Dan Plays Games from the Elder Times as I play a game that's new on Steam called Pool of Radiance. So I'm playing that for the very first time, and you can see me kind of find my way around a game from 1988, and exploring that advanced D&D game there. But enormous thanks to Kieran Gillen today. Such a wonderful conversation, wonderful literature that you write, and a great gaming project. So thanks so much for your time today, Kieran.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been delightful.
Awesome. Of course, we're live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, so please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you.